right, thanks, Marge. So, as Marge mentioned, I am looking at self-silencing in relation to adherence, and then how that also relates to race and abuse history in women with HIV. Nothing to disclose. So again, the purpose of the study is to understand the interaction of those variables that I just mentioned. And so it's more specifically, the questions that we're asking are, okay, how does a potential history of abuse and either sexual or physical abuse and race relate to self-silencing? And then one step further, how does self-silencing and also abuse and race independently, how do those predict adherence? So just a little bit of background on self-silencing. So first, big picture, what gender roles are. So basically, gender roles are personality attributes, behaviors that are prescribed for each gender. So that you can have traditional or non-traditional gender roles. So traditional gender roles conform to these stereotypical conceptualizations that society has for each gender. So for women, it would be something like, okay, women should be more submissive than men. And these can differ across, not only across ethnicities, but even within different ethnicities, across subcultures. And one type of gender role that I'll be focusing on is self-silencing, which is a type of traditional gender role, which is really the focus on suppressing your own needs, both in order to avoid the loss of a relationship and then avoid conflict within an existing relationship, and also to maintain self-esteem. So that's measured by something called the Silencing the Self Scale. It was created by Dana Jack. It's a self-report questionnaire, 31 items, 5-point Likert scale, and the range is from 31 to 155. So just to go into that scale a little bit more, there are sort of four sub-scales that get at different facets of self-silencing. The first is called externalized self-perception, which is basically judging yourself according to the standards that are sort of imposed on you by society at large. So one item is, I tend to judge myself by how I think other people see me. Then there's care of self-sacrifice, which is sort of what it sounds like, prioritizing the care of others over your own self-care. So an example item there is, caring means putting the other person's needs in front of my own. And then divided self, so that's experiencing this conflict between your own inner values and standards, and then how you present behaviorally to the world, and that behavioral presentation is adopted to conform to gendered social norms. So often I look happy enough on the outside, but inwardly I feel angry and rebellious. And then finally, the self-silencing subscale is basically failing to express your own needs if they conflict with the needs or the values of other people in the relationship. So I don't speak my feelings in an intimate relationship when I know they will cause disagreement. And there's been some work on traditional gender roles and how those relate to various health outcomes. So self-silencing impacts communication with healthcare providers. It impacts whether someone negotiates conflict with their partner, and that can include something like condom use. It also impacts whether someone makes self-care or treatment adherence a priority over and above sort of caring for other people. It influences whether someone advocates for themselves in the healthcare setting. It is related to depression and quality of life, and also physical health, so not only with HIV, but also in terms of breast cancer, there have been studies, diabetes, heart disease, and then also HIV risk behaviors and morbidity. So some of the specific risk behaviors that have been looked at include people who are high in self-silencing tend to show lower levels of condom use, so their partners will use condoms less. They might be more likely to have multiple sexual partners or engage in forced sex. And then also there's been some evidence that higher self-silencing relates to lower levels of adherence. to HIV medication. So then just very briefly, in terms of how everything else fits together, there's been little research, but some research on the relationship between self-silencing and ethnicity. And those findings are somewhat mixed. Basically, the research shows that minority women have higher levels of self-silencing than white women in one study. But in another study, it really showed that there wasn't much of a difference across various ethnic groups. So there's some mix there, but I would say more research shows that there's more self-silencing among African American women. And what is more apparent is that poorer adherence is associated with a history of abuse and with being African American, which could be related to self-silencing. The research shows that the reason that African Americans on average are more poorly adherent, it could be associated with racial discrimination and lack of access to healthcare. And then in terms of abuse history and how that relates to gender roles, there's been some mixed research. So a lot of the research does say that women who have a history of abuse tend to self-silence more, but there's also some research that actually says that women who particularly have had abuse in childhood actually then go on to adopt gender roles that are non-traditional. So there's some mixed research there. In terms of the limitations of the previous research, so most of it has been done on small samples or at single sites. The existing literature also doesn't really put all of these variables together. So how do self-silencing, race, and abuse history together influence adherence to antiretrovirals? And then those contradictory findings regarding the impact of abuse history on gender roles. So then that's where our work comes in terms of the hypotheses. So some of these are based on the findings in the previous literature, but we hypothesize that history of abuse will relate independently to higher levels of self-silencing, and that African American race will independently relate to higher levels of self-silencing as well. And then that higher levels of self-silencing will then go on to relate to lower levels of adherence. And then we also predicted an interaction such that having a history of abuse will interact with African American race, such that African American women with a history of abuse will evidence the highest levels of self-silencing. In terms of the participants, there were 534 HIV positive women around midlife, majority African American, low income. So again, this was part of the WISE study. It was a specific sub-study, a gender-based violence sub-study, gender-based violence and coping, and it was across three different sites, so Brooklyn, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. So in terms of the descriptive information, basically this slide shows that many of these women did have a history of abuse, and that was true across the different ethnic groups. In terms of the procedures, women attended the gender-based violence study visit and their six-month WISE core visit, and they provided self-report data about adherence, and they filled out the questionnaire, so the silencing the self scale, they filled that out at that visit. In terms of measures, so the abuse measure was self-report, and the one that we focused on here was lifetime, so we didn't separate out for this particular study the childhood or adulthood or whether it was physical or sexual abuse. So we looked at all of those things in one variable. And then the silencing the self scale, and then an adherence, so that's basically are you 95% adherent or not, and that's based on self-report as well. And then demographic variables. So analyses, basically multiple logistic regressions And the other thing to note is that self-silencing was based on a median split. So basically, what was the median split into high or low? That's how we determined whether each participant was high or low self-silencing. So here's what we found. For women who reported any history of abuse, they were more likely to self-silence than those who did not report an abuse history. And then total self-silencing related to lower likelihood of adherence across all participants. And then some of the more interesting findings were that the self-silencing subscale, which is expressing sort of failing to express your own needs in relationships, that related to lower likelihood of adherence only in African-American women. And then again on the subscale level, divided self related to lower likelihood of adherence only in women who had experienced abuse within their lifetime. And then finally, controlling for abuse, whites were more likely to be adherent than African-Americans. But whites and Hispanics were actually more likely to have higher self-silencing than African-Americans. So this is just showing the means and standard deviations in terms of self-silencing. So it's the total and then divided by subscale across all of the racial groups and in terms of abuse and no history of abuse. And then the interactions here. So this is showing that the divided self and the abuse history, so there is a significant interaction there. So if you look at that, the bar on the right, you can see that women who were high in terms of their divided self and had an abuse history were significantly less, tended to be less adherent than the other groups. So if you see that 58% bar all the way on the right. And then the other interaction, so the self-silencing subscale and race, showed that if you see the second to last bar there, African-American women who were high in self-silencing tended to be less likely to be adherent. So why these differences then? And these are just hypotheses, but it might be that divided self for women who have had a history of abuse might be actually indirectly related to adherence, maybe through depression or self-esteem. It's possible that it might be related to dissociation due to trauma, or it could just impact women's ability to be genuine in a relationship, which could compound the effects of abuse. And then in terms of the self-silencing subscale and the fact that that actually affects adherence in African-American women more, this could be because of systematic inequities in the healthcare system. So this idea is that because African-American women may have fewer resources, they actually need to advocate more for themselves compared to other women who have more resources. And there's definitely more research needed to sort of explore and follow up with these different pathways. In terms of strengths and limitations, it's a cross-sectional design. The measures are self-report. It was sort of like a forced choice ethnic identification, so people could choose other, but you had to check one of the boxes. And then we didn't split it up in terms of types of abuse and its correlational data. Strengths are that it's a large sample size. We're putting all these variables together and that it's a multivariate analysis. So this research indicates that self-silencing might have a greater impact on adherence for African Americans and women with a history of abuse. So what we really need to do is address gender roles, both sort of on a systems level, as well as racial inequities, in order to increase empowerment and self-advocacy and improve HIV care. And the other thing is we really need to take these factors, so self-silencing, whether someone has a history of abuse, and ethnicity, these should all be taken into account, both at the level when you're designing HIV interventions, but also using the existing interventions how to tailor those to individuals. And so I'd like to acknowledge the WISE participants, without whom we wouldn't have a study, and the WISE staff.
That's great. Thank you. Any questions for Dana? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and the short answer is yes, that some of them were, and we're actually, that's going to be one of the next steps, is to look into how that related to these variables.
The WISE actually has an entire study. One out of three women say that they did were involved in transactional sex. So even once they were involved in the study, 10% continue in that work. Any other questions? Yeah.
I was just wondering, I'm doing my dissertation looking at ARD adherence as well, and I was wondering how you actually phrased that question. Was it the visual analog scale, or what you used to capture the self-reported adherence?
So Kathleen, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is it's both a visual analog scale and a verbal report. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So it's a modified MASRI, if you do that research. So it's similar to the AIDS clinical trial group, so you're asking both of all of your medications in general, what is your adherence? So it's by 5% increments, and then later it was 10% increments. So then each antiretroviral, we ask for each antiretroviral type what is adherence. So you can give adherence on the biggest level of just overall, and then for investigators,
okay, so go ahead, Harold. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I got it. Thank you, Howard. That's a very important question. I think Leslie tried to address it at the beginning of her presentation, and it's sort of why we had the film in the beginning, too, which I think you were here to see, which really describes in the women's voices what their issues were with that poverty and how it affected them and what interventions worked for them, which when I hear the film were institutions and other women with HIV sort of being there for them to get through, to then think of what else they want to do to change their lives. And part of what we wanted to do today, even in the context of the Socialist Caucus presentations, was to have those women's voices heard, have young investigators who are looking at qualitative data, because the quantitative data actually doesn't answer these questions at all. And then hear the voice of someone who actually is in the study to see if any of this mattered to her, and think about what what it means to her and how she has taken this, all these sort of difficulties, and what method she's used for intervention. So it was at an individual level, but I think it has meaning. And we've done many, many sessions. Socialist Caucus has been incredibly wonderful to the Women's HIV study in Chicago to enable us to actually present lots of years on a lot of the different areas that we've looked at. We'll be presenting more on incarceration this afternoon, and the large picture is one that I think everyone here worries about a lot, an enormous amount of struggle that the women have actually forced themselves to do, and many, many others in this country, to actually deal with their care. So I think it doesn't answer your question totally, but I think we are aware and care a lot and actually struggle daily, both in the clinic office as well as in the study and how to deal with the data that we're looking at, to actually do, to make it be much more than at the individual level. But I want to give Marta a chance, and then we could actually probably go back to that discussion, which I think, you know, I was aware of the entire time we were talking to.
Well, so, I was thinking, Marta, if you could maybe talk a little bit about the conversation this morning about how
I think she knows. So Marta, so let me just tell you who she is. Marta Santiago is the Chicago representative to the WISE National Community Advisory Board for the past 20 years. She's a mother and a grandmother. And in the 1990s, she was instrumental in guiding providers like me at Cook County Hospital, making a program for women and children that was truly family-centered.
Thank you.
You have a big job,
Marta. Yes. You know, watching and listening to these presentations here, I mean, my whole life just went right in front of me and took me back to some specific memories. You know, but I'm going back six decades, starting out from, I don't know what pictures you saw up there of me, but I was looking at the book and I go, oh my gosh, I was a little bride for my cousin's entering the priesthood in the book in there, I'm a little bride. And I thought, but I was already damaged. And I think I was like 4 years old because I was abused by the uncles. I talked about being around the uncles and aunts and grandpa and grandma. There began the silencing. And now I've come to terms with that I've withheld myself because of things. That's how I was brought up. Finally got off to get married, and well, that was another episode of, you know, but in between that time, Mom was the one that was at home a lot. I was learning from Mom to be the backbone, as a lot of women in the study have said, that they're the backbone of the family because the Mom is who keeps the family together. And here I learned what I could from Mom, and when I was able to, she had to work three jobs, so I was the one at home taking care of everybody coming home from school. I was, like one of the ladies said, she was a mom at 13. I was a mom already by 9. I was taking care of the little ones, my younger brother and my younger sister. You know, so I had to do the little cooking and the washing, and I was mentioning to some of the girls how I got my hand stuck in the wringer, you know, those old wooden wringers from way back when. But that was instilled in me, but I still had that quiet, you know, just do what I'm supposed to do, and off to marriage, and I thought, well, okay, I'm equipped for this, and sure enough, had my daughter, but I wasn't equipped for it because then the abuse came in, a different style of abuse. When I was younger, it was sexual. When I was older, it was physical. I was thinking of one of the pictures in there, too. I said, oh, God, my daughter was maybe 3-4 months old, and I know there were times that I was, you know, showing the style of a black guy, and I remember one time my uncle asked me, what happened to you? And all I could think of was what I heard on TV. I ran into a door. But silencing, I kept it to myself, you know, unless it was obvious. From then, it was me, myself. How was I going to cope? Had a little one. Once the time came, I ran into different people. I had a job, but then the drugs came in. All of that was a dark shadow in my life, a dark shadow for a while there. I learned that, got out of that. Once I got out of that, I got back to another marriage, and I had my son. So I had two. And what did I do? I tried to make up for all lost time. And I had that instilled in me as a woman. I'm taking care of house, children, family. I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do. Ran into Cook County's place. I mean, that was the biggest part of my life there, that I had support. And I had a common denominator of all these other women, that their stories were super horrendous. Mine was like, well, you know, just a pass, you know. But nothing compared to some of the stories I heard from the other women. So always trying to make up for stuff. And of course, my pride and joy is that one of the best times I remember was that for Father's Day, the kids got me a Father's Day card because I was mother and father to them. And I thought, oh, gee, you know, am I really, did I earn this? And sure enough, you know, even though they had communications with their respective fathers, but still, you know, I got a Father's Day card. And I was told, you know, oh, my, you're mom and pop. But, you know, my kids are good. I've had the opportunity to work. And I found that working is what really matters. You've got to have a goal. Keeping a roof over their head. Having food in the fridge. Enough to make a meal every day that were, you know, either breakfast or dinner, you know, or both of them, I should say, actually, because I never, that was one of the things, I would never let them go out of the house without breakfast. Couldn't go to sleep without dinner. But these are the things that, you know, silencing, adherence, you know, I had to keep to a schedule for the last 20 some odd years. Since 1989, I've been taking my medication faithfully at night between the hours of 9:30 and 10:30. You know, there's just certain things that automatically are instilled in me, and I do. I still help other people out. I take other people to their appointments or get them in the door for translation purposes. I'm doing that now. I mean, whatever it is that I can do, but that's me. And it's, I don't know if it's the struggles, if it's, you know, okay, let me get this out of the way, not put it to the side, so I ain't got to worry about it, because I know sometimes holding on to something is just going to cause more stress. That I've learned a long time ago. And I used to tell my kids, if it spills, pick it up, don't worry about it, then it's picked up. And I have to say that I'm very proud of my children, that they've, you know, come their way and no problems, and I guess they're a reflection of how things were brought up, not always well, but yes, we were talking about this on the way, having a job. And having a job and making your own way, that is really, really important. And of course, I got that chance at county. I got that chance at county. But that was a real quick through, you know, what, you know, and I've never missed my appointments. I've talked openly with all of my providers, answered all of those very personal questions, you know, through all of the questionnaires all these years. And when I've found that when I talk to other newcomers or people that are in a situation, all I could do is give them, hey, this is what happened to me. Doesn't mean it's going to happen to you, but look at it this way. There's a tomorrow, you know. There's always tomorrow. Or the bills are still going to come.
Comments, questions?
Yes, sorry.
Health versus pharmaceutical company heroinist, which you'll hear more about if you do have it in that terrific section organized by Cynthia Pearson, the National Women's Health Network, Kamui Jagger, Breast Cancer Action. Enough about that, but I also would like to invite people who are interested in being involved with the Socialist Caucus and participating in sessions or even just finding out once a year what we're up to. Please feel free to sign the sign-up sheet. I'll pass it around. And thanks very much, Marge and presenters, for a terrific panel.
Thank you. Any other comments? Bobby, Kathy, Howard.
Been a few years and what's been going on, and any more years that these issues have been discussed. I wonder if there's any comparative data in terms of time. I mean, the definitions of gender that you're and self-silence and that you're talking about, are they the same in 2015 as they were in 2000? And how does that affect the several hypotheses that we've forward today?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great question. I just came from a panel on transgender individuals and health and how definitions of that and how it's impacting healthcare. So it's something we have to keep a close look on. And in particular, you know, are gender roles in the African American community different than in, you know, the sort of stereotype of the strong black woman? Is that different than traditional gender roles for white women? So you have to look at differences both at time points and also within different ethnic groups. And so, yes, we try to do that and keep up with it, but it's an ongoing, you know, process. You know, what was considered traditional then might not be now, et cetera. So it's really something we need to keep looking at.
And I guess I would add to that, you know, when the individual issues that we've talked about allow women to deal with self-silencing and actually the misogyny that causes self-silencing, then we will be more in a position to work with women who have HIV and have them actually move us forward to deal with, I think, the sort of larger oppressive institutions that, you know, Howard was asking us to challenge. So I think that in my mind they're very related from every sort of experience I've had in like how to really impact public health. So I think it's different than it was like when we started HIV. You know, because think, I mean, we've all been doing it now for a good 25, 30 years. But it's not different enough, I feel. You know, I mean, that's what I think.
And the self-silencing has been studied internationally. There's a book that came out just recently, and it relates internationally to depression among women and poorer health. So, I mean, it's still alive and well. And just in relation, I think it's Howard. Your question, you know, I don't think it's an either or. I mean, clearly there are these massive social inequities that are producing these things, but at an individual level, there's still a suffering individual there whom we try to help. So being impacted by those social inequities and who has a lot to say about them, I think, as well. So I think as Marta so clearly articulated how they impacted her, and I think that's what we're trying to get at. So it's not an either or by any means.